Item number eight, state. Yes.
Okay, sorry to interrupt, but I did have a miss on the family forest land report, listing as informational item. There is a recommendation where the Committee of Family Forest Land recommends a board accept the CFF annual report and the updated CFF charter. And given the charter establishes new governance procedures, which have been spoken to, much appreciative, it would be worthwhile to take a moment to see if there's a motion to accept that and go ahead and honor that request.
Sounds
I move that we accept the charter.
And the report.
Second.
The charter
and the report.
Okay. It's been moved and seconded to accept both the charter and the report. Any discussion? Okay, let me go through our list. Cindy Deacon-Williams.
Aye.
Joe Justice.
Aye.
Jim Kelly.
Aye.
Brenda McComb.
Aye.
Mike Rose.
Aye.
And Tom Ineson is also for it. So the motion passes unanimously. Thank you.
Technically, who seconded it? We couldn't tell.
Mike Rose.
Mike Rose,
thank you, Mike.
Okay. Liz, you're up. This is an informational item, but hopefully one that will generate a lot of good discussion.
Hi, Mr. Henson. Can you just turn on your microphone real quick and see if we can hear you, your video as well?
Yeah, this is Paul. Hello. Test.
Loud and clear. Thank you.
Are we ready? Is that good? Okay, great. Thank you, Hillary. Good afternoon, Chair Imeson, State Forester Doherty, members of the board. For the record, my name is Liz Dent, and I serve as a State Forest Division Chief. We're here today to provide an update on our Western Oregon State Forest Habitat Conservation Plan, and we've not been in front of you to discuss the planning process in general, including the forest management plan work, the draft FMP work, for quite a while, since last fall. So there's been a lot of work done, a lot of accomplishments, and yet still a lot of work to go. But we do have a fair amount to cover today, so we're gonna try to jump right in and get this going. I think as you all know, we set this project up as a three-phased approach, with phase one being to evaluate if it was in the best interest of the state to pursue an HCP. And if yes, that we would then begin drafting an HCP in collaboration with our state and federal agencies. So you may recall that we presented that what we called the business case to you in November of 2018 to inform that decision. And you in fact directed the division to move into what we call phase two, which has entailed the development of a draft habitat conservation plan. We'll be returning to you in October of this year for you to make your next decision as to if you want us to continue working on the HCP and move into the NEPA process. So we're here today to, to present updates on phase two. There has been just a monumental amount of work that's been accomplished by multiple agencies with support of several contractors. We have summaries of our approach to terrestrial and aquatic conservation measures and some information on some anticipated outcomes. So a lot to share again. Joining me here at the table this morning are Brian Pugh. He's actually on virtually joining us, I guess I'd say, out of the Wallawa office, our State Forest Deputy Division Chief. Mike Wilson's here in Salem, State Forest Resource and Information Unit Leader. Cindy Kolomacek, our State Forest Project Manager for the Habitat Conservation Plan. Troy Ramig with ICF, and he's joining us virtually. And Brett Brownscrum with Oregon Consensus, also joining us virtually. On several occasions, we've established and shared with you that we have established a steering committee and a scoping team to facilitate the technical work and policy discussions and direction around developing this HCP. And so I just want to take a few minutes to recognize the folks that are serving on those teams from our state and federal sister agencies. They truly have invested significant time and resources, and I just want to take a few minutes to thank them. So joining us here today, and they'll have a few minutes to talk, are Paul Hansen. He's the Fish and Wildlife Service Oregon State Supervisor. Kim Kratz with NOAA Fisheries, Oregon and Washington Coastal Office, and he's the Assistant Regional Administrator. Doug Cottom serves as the ODFW Wildlife Division Administrator, so here for the state's Department of Fish and Wildlife. Leah Felden is the DEQ Deputy Director. Bill Ryan is the DSL Deputy Director for Operations. Dan Edge, he's OSU Associate Dean of the College of Ag Sciences and Professor of Wildlife at Oregon State University. All these folks serve on our steering committee, and again, they actively engage during and between those meetings to help maintain alignment and momentum on the HCP, and we definitely would not be where we are today without their leadership, so sincere thank you to those folks. And then our scoping team, these are the technical folks from these agencies, from our own agency and from our sister agencies. So I've already introduced Brian Pugh, Cindy Kolomachek, and Mike Wilson. Randy Smith, he's our own ODF wildlife biologist. Nick Palazzato, again, our ODF wildlife biologist. Julie Furman is with ODFW. She's a fisheries biologist. Rod Kramer, ODFW Forest Practices Coordinator. Ryan Singleton is with DSL. He's their forester. Josh Seeds is with DEQ. He's their TMDL manager. Jim Muck is with NOAA Fisheries. He's their fish biologist. Terry O'Rourke, NOAA Fisheries, Oregon Coast Branch Chief. Rich Slemp, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service biologist. And then Dr. Klaus Putman is serving as a technical reviewer, giving us some assistance from Oregon State University. So I know it took some time to tick through all that, and I'm confident many of these people are actually dialed in and watching this presentation today. They really deserve a deep sense of gratitude and appreciation for all their hard work and helping us get to where we are today. And certainly want to make it worth their while, because there's a lot more work to go. So thanks to all of you for your hard work on this. I think what also is important to recognize is that all of us are coming from different agencies with different mandates and missions, different governing bodies, stakeholders that have different opinions and values. And they have consistently come to the table. All of these folks have consistently come to the table during these scoping team meetings and our steering committee meetings to help shape the long-term approach to managing these state forests. So it's a really important investment. So before jumping into the presentation, I would like to allow some time here. We've asked Paul Hansen from U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and Kim Kratz if they'd be willing to take a few minutes and share some of their perspectives on the process. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to you, Paul.
Okay, thank you, Liz. So for the record, my name is Paul Hansen. As Liz said, I'm the state supervisor for U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service here in Oregon. Got a long history in Oregon, although I did leave the state for a couple of stints, one in Hawaii and one in California, but came back to Oregon 12 years ago. And I've been working on these issues since then as a state supervisor. I'll just make a couple of big picture comments on the HCP process and the Western Oregon Forest HCP. And then if the board has questions, maybe after Kim has said NOAA's perspective as well, be happy to stick around as long as you want and answer any questions. So as most of you know, the basic purpose of the HCP process is to grant a permit, an incidental take permit for take of federally listed species under the ESA, and that provides legal sufficiency and some legal certainty for the applicant, in this case, the state of Oregon. During these last 25 years, I've worked on HCPs in five states, and these have run the gamut from very small single landowner HCPs to statewide HCPs, range-wide, statewide for different species. And this includes several HCPs in Oregon and in the Pacific Northwest over those years. Timber harvest is just one type of HCP activity, although I think, of course, here in the Northwest and Western Oregon, it's sort of the dominant HCP issue, but we're working on water diversion, farm irrigation, recreational HCPs, power generation, residential and business development HCPs. So it's a wide variety of activities, economic activities. And I guess the one common theme in that variety is it's never easy doing an HCP. It's a public process. It involves a wide diversity of stakeholders and priorities. And sometimes those priorities are competing, as we've already touched on a little bit. And they're always challenging, controversial. And I think just showing the list of folks that Liz mentioned, they're labor intensive. But as exhausting as the process can be, in my experience, and certainly working with a lot of landowners, it's generally well worth completing that process, as tough as it can be sometimes. And one landowner commented to me several years ago that the only thing worse than doing an HCP is not doing an HCP. So I mentioned that because we're kind of in some crunch time right now in this HCP, and a lot invested, but still some hard work ahead of us to complete it. But in recognition of complexity of that process, several decades ago, the Fish and Wildlife Service created a granting program for HCP planning. And as you've heard, ODF has received two grants totaling $1.5 million from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to help underwrite the cost and process for this plan. And that's, you know, though, for these large complex plans, sometimes you really do need that kind of support and a shot in the arm. In my opinion, ODF and the consultants have done a really good job of engaging the public and putting together a robust and transparent process. And I'm pretty confident that even though we'll have some intense negotiations and we've got to come to a few more agreements and compromise probably on as Liz queued up, you know, the people have a wide variety of opinions on what's necessary to be done. I'm very confident that we'll get to this across the finish line, and a permit will be issued in the timeframe that's outlined in the materials that you have in your package. So with that, I just want to say thanks and turn it over to Kim Kratz at NOAA Fisheries. And again, if you folks have questions, happy to answer them on this HCP or any big or small aspects of this process. Thank you.
We'll turn it over to you then, Kim, and then we'll come back to the board for questions.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
All right. Thanks, Paul. Thanks, Liz. Good afternoon, Chair Imason, members of the board, and State Forester Dougherty. For the record, I'm Kim Kratz. I'm the Assistant Regional Administrator for the Oregon-Washington Coastal Office, NOAA Fisheries. And I'm here today to convey to you NOAA Fisheries' continuing support of the development of a habitat conservation plan for the Western Oregon forests. NOAA has appreciated the opportunity to have been part of this pretty intensive but collaborative and productive effort over the past 2 years. NOAA Fisheries remains committed to this effort, as we believe that this effort could lead to a habitat conservation plan for the Western Oregon State Forest that would address the habitat needs of federally listed salmonids and the economic sustainability needed through the management of Oregon forests. And should the board decide to move forward with NEPA and the October decision that Liz identified, NOAA has agreed to be the lead action agency on that effort. So NOAA Fisheries' mission of sustaining fisheries for economic purposes and recovering federally listed species can be challenging. From our perspective, an HCP would assist in providing for healthy, sustainable fisheries for economic purposes, and it would also support the economic needs of the forestry community. The economic viability and conservation of species, we feel, can work hand in hand. And the HCP is a tool that is proved to be effective in providing both of these. So this collaboration remains a priority for NOAA Fisheries because we believe there is a significant and an enduring value in both the biological and ecological security that an HCP would provide for the salmonids in the geography of the HCP. And we are also confident that this can be achieved while addressing the economic, the social, and other environmental goals of the state of Oregon. So I thank you much for the opportunity to be here today, and I'll turn this back to Liz.
Great, thank you, Kim. Kim and Paul, thank you very much for joining us. And I'd open it up to the board members if you have any questions for Kim and Paul before we get into the rest of our presentation.
And it's Tom. I don't see hands raised, so I'll just, again, say if anybody has any questions, this is the time where we have these two folks. But in the meantime, I want to thank you both for your participation in the process and also your participation in our discussion here today. And it looks like we can move on, Liz. Thanks.
Okay, so let's pull our presentation up then. Kim and Paul's definitely welcome to stick around and join us for the rest of the presentation. We may end up asking you to answer questions if we can't. But other than that, we'll go ahead and move to the presentation, and the folks we have queued up are myself, Brian, Mike Wilson, Cindy Kolomachek, Troy Ramig, and Brett Brownscombe. Next slide. So we do have a lot to cover today. Did want to just take a moment and remind you about the geographic scope for the Habitat Conservation Plan. This is an exciting time in Oregon where we have multiple habitat conservation plans either actively being worked on or being contemplated. So I would say this is an important moment in time for forestry in Oregon in that way. It can be tempting to compare and contrast habitat conservation plans against each other. But it's important to keep in mind that HCPs reflect the landowners' objectives, their mandates, the land base that they're managing. So the forest conditions, habitat conditions, the species they want to cover, et cetera. So in the case of our HCP, we're proposing to cover 16 species, roughly 635,000 acres from the northwest corner of the state to the California border, with a legal mandate to achieve greatest permanent value. So it's inevitable that the ODF Habitat Conservation Plan is going to look a little bit different than some of the other ones that are being contemplated in Oregon today. Our conservation measures are still being refined, and the estimates and outcomes that we're going to be sharing with you today are preliminary. We did share this work with the public last week, and we will continue to work with our sister state and federal agencies and our contractors to further refine and develop the draft Habitat Conservation Plan. Next slide. So move through the presentation today, towards the end of the presentation, Brian Pugh will be talking about some of the management outcomes and characterizing the, and as will Mike Wilson, and characterizing those by what we're calling three different sub-geo-regions. And so those are presented here on this graph. And Brian, towards the end of the presentation, will discuss our rationale for that. So today we're going to give you a little bit of an update on the HCP process itself, including the county and stakeholder engagement, and then touch on the conservation strategies, including the aquatic and terrestrial strategies, the forest management modeling, and an outline of our forest goals and objectives, and then we'll close off by going over next steps. Before I hand it over to Cindy, I just will say a couple things. Our stakeholders have been very patient, waiting for us to share details until just last week, and we're getting feedback from them, as you are, and I just want to emphasize that we remain committed to the strong public engagement and responding to what we're hearing from our stakeholders. So do for the stakeholders that are logged on today and listening to this meeting, want to thank you as well for your patience and waiting for us to get that material out, and recognize that there's a lot more work to do. One thing that I would say has become abundantly clear to me is that managing this forest land base is going to become increasingly challenging without an HCP. It's expensive and it's inefficient. There's uncertainty associated with third-party lawsuits, new listings, evolving expectations for conservation measures for currently listed species, and then just the need to establish a social political license to manage. There's several benefits of having an HCP that are linked to certainty. An HCP provides a certainty for the conservation of the habitat, certainty and assurances to ODF to continue to actively manage these lands, including timber harvest. And this translates to certainty of timber-related revenue to counties and support for timber-related economies. Certainty is also positive from the perspective of the department's business decisions and funding our State Forest Division. And this certainty, should we successfully get through this HCP process and end up with an HCP, is something that would play out over multiple decades. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to Cindy.
Thank you, Liz, and thank you, Paul and Kim. Good afternoon, Chair Imeson, State Forester Doherty, and members of the board. For the record, my name is Cindy Kolomaychuk, and I serve as the project manager for the Western Oregon HCP. As Liz mentioned, we've been working really hard with our steering committee and our scoping team on developing the first administrative draft of the HCP. Now, this administrative draft is a comprehensive document that addresses many aspects of ESA compliance. And so our planning teams have really been focused on the chapters that are shown in the blue arrows here. And that's because these are the chapters that really provide the foundational elements of the HCP. So the scope and the scale, the covered activities and the covered species, as well as the conservation and economic outcomes that would inform the comparative analysis and ultimately the board's decision on whether or not to move forward into NEPA in October. If so directed, then we would move into that green line there that shows that we're going to continue to make refinements on that administrative draft. And so there will be refining the chapters that are more administrative and operational in nature. And it looks here that we would be completing that sort of at the end of this year and the beginning of next year, so early spring of 2021. And that timing works out really well because NOAA anticipates that that is when they would be ready to launch the NEPA process. So we'll be able to move seamlessly into the NEPA process if so directed. At the same time, if you'll move down there onto the darker blue line, we will begin developing the companion FMP. And we are anticipating that will be finished by November of 2021, at which time we would take it to the board for your consideration. And the thought here is that we would complete this companion FMP and then bring the fully vetted HCP to the board in June of 2022. So it's about 6 months from when we bring the companion FMP to you. I will caveat that by saying that the NEPA process is a federal process, and so we are at the mercy of their timeline, but that is the collective goal of the group, is to have it done as efficiently as possible. Now, Brett Brownscombe is going to cover county and stakeholder engagement, but before he does so, I'd like to provide an update on our engagement with our tribal partners to date. And I'd like to acknowledge that ODF recognizes and respects that the Indigenous people are the traditional stewards of the lands that we currently manage. And we seek to honor this relationship by engaging the tribes in the development of the HCP so that they may continue to be connected to and benefit from their traditional territories. At our most recent meeting open to the public, which was just a couple of weeks ago, there were 6 tribal representatives from the Coquille tribe and the confederated tribes of Coos, Lower Umpqua, and the Siuslaw Indians. In addition, State Forester Doherty, Liz, and myself met with the Grand Ronde Tribal Council last December in 2019. And we'll continue working directly with tribal staff to further our understanding of how we can honor their interest in the lands that we currently manage. And so with that, I am going to turn it over to Brett.
Great. Thanks, Cindy. And so for the record, Chair Imeson, State Forester Doherty, and members of the board, it's good to see you. My name is Brett Brownscombe, and I work for Oregon Consensus out of Portland State University's Hatfield School of Government. And along with Kearns and West, Oregon Consensus, and Kearns and West have been working on third-party independent process support in those roles for the state agency and federal agency spaces, as well as the externally facing process around HCP development. So I'm here to present some brief information today to you around the external engagement process. Okay, good. We're on that slide. Thanks, Cindy. So the brief review of what we've done since the last board update to you all is this. There have been broad public meetings, kind of y'all come big invitation lists in March and July. And there's been big interest and turnout in those meetings, despite us needing to use a virtual platform in light of COVID-19, or maybe because of us using a virtual platform. And then we've done, aside from those meetings in March and July, the most recent one being July 13th, we've been doing additional stakeholder engagement. And what this slide, by way of interest group meetings, means is that includes conservation, forest product sector, recreation, state forest advisory committee members, and those groups of people. And the focus has been on, as this slide shows, the key issues and components relevant to a potential HCP. And some of these focus group meetings have involved time with the state forester directly, and he and the State Forest Division Chief Liz have been committed to offering their continued engagement where it's helpful. So what we've been hearing, in a nutshell, and I'll be brief on this because it's still coming, is the existence of an external process is appreciated. And I think folks in the public and in across stakeholder and county governments understand that this process is an addition to NEPA. This is not NEPA. This is not a NEPA process, and ODF has other commitments and obligations around other venues where it engages with people. But this is in addition to that, and I think the existence of this externally facing process has been appreciated. Like Liz mentioned, the overarching message has been there's just been a thirst for more detail and more information, and I think we're at that point right now where at the July 13th public meeting, the conservation strategy draft chapter was rolled out. And that's the level of detail a lot of people have been wanting, and people want more detail than that. But we're at a point where some of that thirst is being satisfied. And now that people are seeing the draft work, we're at the point of hearing their reactions based on how they perceive the draft product and whether it meets their interests. Next slide. So county engagement. I wanted to speak to this first. And let me just be sure I'm on the... Yeah, there we go. So the FTLAC, and this has been addressed in some of the comments you've heard, but the Forest Trust Land Advisory Committee meeting space has historically been and remains the desired venue for engagement here. And unfortunately, since December 2019, that was the last occurrence of an FTLAC meeting. And since that time, a variety of factors, not the least of which is COVID-19, have caused counties to cancel the FTLAC meetings. So in light of this, ODF and the process team members, we've continued to outreach and have communication with counties. And that includes expressing availability and interest in engaging, sharing information, and seeking feedback. And we intend to continue to do this. We're following different pathways of engagement than just the FTLAC meeting venue at this point, and that includes, for example, because of the July 10th FTLAC meeting cancellation, ODF went to, with a direct invite, directly to county commissioners for the July 13th public meeting, where presentation occurred on items that counties had expressed an interest in. And commissioners showed up. There were, I think, four there from Clatsop County, both current and elected in waiting, and then one from Benton County. We've also been, in following the advice of counties, engaging directly with Mark Rasmussen from Mason, Bruce, and Girard. Mark's a contracted consultant to the counties, and we've been providing information that the counties have requested both to and through him. The process also continues to value the FTLAC space, and we will continue to express interest in engaging in formal FTLAC meetings should they occur. And regardless of that, even if they don't, the State Forest Division Chief remains in communication with the FTLAC chair and regarding process updates, information sharing, and receiving feedback. And we plan to engage in direct individual conversations with county commissioners. So I think the fact is it's not meeting through the FTLAC forum isn't desirable. It wasn't a contemplated part of the process. And the relationship with the counties is really important, as you all know. That said, the process is continuing to pursue engagement pathways to honor that relationship with the counties. And information's ready at this point that is relevant to county interests, and it's important for the process, we feel, to provide that information and to try to hear from all perspectives within relevant county governments. So next slide. This slide here is a graphic that depicts the process, the timeline and the process approach to public engagement in the HCP. And it doesn't include everything. It could get messier, but the key piece to notice here about the process for now is that the public meeting engagement checkpoints are driven by, the animation worked. The checkpoints on when we hold meetings are driven by the HCP work product, which are those things within the red oval that are coming out of the planning teams, the scoping team and the steering committee process. And these are the work products. The key components are elements of the HCP. And so once we have a set of work products ready coming out of those planning teams, the first release point is with the FTLAC, honoring the board and department's relationship with the counties. And we also hold those full broad public meetings to get the work product pieces out transparently. And that's the one we just had on July 13th, and the yellow oval circle at the bottom of the slide, that depicts where we are now in the process. And then following those public meetings, we hold additional meetings, focus group meetings, and conversations to get feedback. So what does the process do with the feedback, or how do people's feedback, how does it get addressed? And in short, it's iterative. So the feedback comes in through the meetings on the draft work product, and then it's conveyed back to the planning teams. And then as subsequent iterations of the work product are done, the process is designed to clarify for those who provided feedback where it was integrated, or if it wasn't, why. And this process has worked its way through at this point from initial input through revision, through final product, or final draft work product, I should say, through the covered species chapters, the covered area, the mission, vision, goals, and the biological goals and objective components of the HCP work. And the stakeholder and the county input and feedback to date has also shaped the development of the conservation strategy draft. So given that the important details on that conservation strategy are have just recently been released, we're currently in the midst of that iterative process of receiving feedback and figuring out how to address it. The future meetings, which I'll cover on the next slide, are part of this. And, you know, this has been touched on a bit already, but ultimately the HCP effort is a negotiation with the federal services over or for a regulatory permit providing Endangered Species Act compliance coverage and other legal assurances for ODFs, timber harvest, recreation, and conservation management activities. And so the ability to really address feedback and make changes to the HCP work products is limited by the you know, what it takes to gain federal service ESA compliance determination, and B, the practical and policy factors related to ODF state forest business model and related greatest permanent value commitments towards timber, county revenue, public forest use and conservation. And the, as you might imagine, the counties and stakeholders have varying perspectives around those things. And that said, the process goal here is by the time the first draft amendment or the draft administrative draft HCP is complete and before you as a board for consideration, the goal here is that the counties, stakeholders, and the broader public should have had a chance to see, review, and provide feedback on the key component parts of the draft HCP, not wordsmithing per se, but the concepts and important elements of the HCP. And they should understand how their feedback has been treated. So there's technical expertise to do this through ODF in-house, also with sister state agencies, and through hired professionals to assist. And I think it's worth noting again that all of this process predates any NEPA process, and it's not obligatory. It's a part of a proactive strategy that ODF and the board wanted to take, and it's not the only place for public engagement. The NEPA process, should the board go there, would continue that public outreach, review, and comment. And I think that's worth noting. So the final slide here is what's next. And as you can see, the future touch points on the horizon and the things that will occur before your board meeting in October is continued engagement with the counties. And continuing to try to engage through FTLAC meetings, but also having individual representative conversations. And then with stakeholders, having some joint focus group meetings, doing that together in August and September with diverse stakeholders, and then having individual representative conversations as well as engagement of the State Forest Advisory Committee in September. And then on September 16th, this is highlighted, that's the next big open to the public meeting where the next iteration of draft product would be put back out in a transparent way. And that's September 16th from 1 to 4 p.m. We had a lot of engagement at the July 13th meeting, over 110 plus people. Including interest from the board and legislature. And so we know there's a lot of interest. And with that, if there are no questions, I'll hand it off to Mike Wilson from ODF to discuss the riparian conservation strategy.
Chair Imason, State Forester Doherty, members of the board, for the record, my name is Mike Wilson, and I am the Resource Support Unit Manager for the State Forest Division. I'm pleased to present you with an update on our HCP conservation strategies today. And while they are still draft, we have made significant progress in their development and are confident that we are on track to arrive at a final set of strategies that will benefit the covered species and provide certainty for our management activities. I would like to begin with an update on the HCP riparian conservation strategies. The riparian conservation strategy is designed to meet the biological goals and objectives for the listed fish species, as well as the Cascade and Columbia Torrent salamanders. Specifically, they will support the species persistence across the permit area over time. This is accomplished through conservation actions that focus on providing for a properly functioning aquatic system over time. Riparian conservation areas form the primary conservation action, providing for buffered areas with little or no management around streams and stream-related features that allow for the natural recruitment of wood into the aquatic system, limit temperature impacts, and minimize sediment delivery. Management direction and best management practices for roads will minimize the potential impacts of our transportation networks to streams. Finally, restoration activities will be implemented to provide key habitat features in shorter time frames, using activities that range from small-scale wood enhancement projects to larger floodplain reconnection projects. The strategies are focused on certain key processes: promoting in-stream habitat complexity primarily through wood recruitment, minimizing stream temperature impacts to fish-bearing streams, and minimizing sediment delivery and providing proper sediment routing, using buffers and road practices, a holistic approach that addresses the functions, including sediment delivery. Again, the cornerstone of the strategy are riparian conservation areas designed to provide long-term protections to properly functioning processes for the riparian and aquatic environment. The RCAs are essentially stream buffers applied in a tiered fashion, dependent on stream classification with corresponding minimum buffer widths. Buffer distances are horizontal distances, which translate to a greater effective slope distance as stream adjacent slope increases. I'll touch more on that in a moment. Riparian conservation areas receive little to no management. Normal operational exceptions that are expected to occur, such as road, stream crossings, and yarding corridors, will be implemented using management direction and best management practices that minimize their effect. Those effects will be evaluated by the services based on the frequency of occurrence and be reported annually during implementation. Before we go over the RCA buffer widths, I would like to present some additional detail on the aquatic zone and implementation of horizontal versus slope distance. The aquatic zone is inclusive of channel complexities, whether we have a well-defined channel, stream-associated wetlands or beaver ponds, side channels and other stream sinuosity or channel migration zones, and stream banks, seeps, and springs. Where the black arrow is pointing in these diagrams indicates where the buffer starts. So that is the edge of the aquatic zone. Also, the buffer distances are in horizontal distances. As you can see in this simple diagram, as the stream adjacent slope increases, the effective distance of the buffer along the slope increases as well. For instance, a 120-foot buffer on a 70% slope has a distance along the slope of 146 feet. The riparian conservation areas are buffers with little to no management and vary in width according to fish presence, stream size, perennial versus seasonal stream flow, and stream-associated features such as potential debris flow tracks and high-energy seasonal streams. As you will notice on this slide, all of our fish-bearing perennial streams receive a 120-foot buffer. Seasonal fish-bearing streams receive a 50-foot buffer. For our type N non-fish streams that are large and medium, they also receive a 120-foot buffer. When it comes to small streams, small perennial type N streams have a base buffer width of 35 feet. However, within the first 500 feet of stream above the upper extent of fish use, they have a 120-foot buffer. This provides for increased shading for temperature recovery before the water mixes with fish-bearing water, and also for additional wood recruitment. For seasonal streams that are potential debris flow tracks or high energy reaches, they also have a base buffer width of 35 feet, But within that same 500-foot zone above the extent of fish use, they have a 50-foot buffer to allow for additional wood recruitment. This ensures that when high flow events occur or when potential debris flow torrents occur, that there is wood delivery, valuable habitat to the stream. Seasonal streams that are not potential debris flows or high energy do not have a tree buffer, but are protected by a 35-foot equipment restriction zone intended to protect the seasonal channel and minimize disturbance to non-tree vegetation. I'll show you a couple of diagrams of how this plays out. As we move from top to bottom in this slide, you can see where a seasonal type F stream enters a perennial type F stream. The perennial type F stream has a 120-foot buffer, and of course the 50-foot buffer on the seasonal stream. Below that is a potential debris flow track or high energy reach, which has a base buffer width of 35 feet, but as it comes to a point of 500 feet above the confluence with the type F stream, the buffer is expanded to 50 feet. And on the bottom, we have a regular seasonal stream with no particular dynamics associated with it, with the equipment restriction zone of 35 feet. This next slide puts it all together a little bit better. On top, we have a small perennial type F stream that feeds into a larger perennial type F stream. So, of course, the small perennial type F stream has a 120-foot buffer for it as well. Then above the upper extent of fish use is an additional 500 feet at 120-foot buffer to cover the small perennial type N. Above that temperature protection zone, it goes down to 35 feet to the initiation of perenniality, where we add an additional 100 feet above the perenniality initiation point of 35-foot buffer. The reason that we add that is we recognize that flow varies from year to year, and we want to make sure that we are capturing the full potential variation in where that perennial initiation point might occur. Above that, the stream transitions to a seasonal type N stream with the equipment restriction zone of 35 feet. In the example on bottom, note the orange dashed line that flows from an initiation point upslope down to the fish-bearing stream. This is a potential debris flow track and sets the stage for the buffering of this particular reach. So again, where we have a small perennial type N above the fish-bearing stream, there's a 120-foot temperature protection zone. Above that point, the small perennial type N reduces to 35 feet, and then through the perenniality initiation point, continues as a 35-foot buffer up to the point where a debris flow track may initiate. Now, a couple of particulars about this. First, the 50-foot buffer for the debris flow track that was noted in the table that I showed you is actually encompassed in this case, is incorporated completely within the 120-foot buffer that is also the temperature protection zone for the small perennial type N. The second thing I'd like to point out is that the point of initiation for the debris flow is not necessarily a point, but an area or set of areas that are evaluated by geotechnical staff and buffered accordingly. So that particular point varies quite a bit in the field as to how it's actually buffered. ICF and ODF work together with TerrainWorks, that's Lee Benda and Dan Miller, to conduct modeling to validate the adequacy of the RCA strategies. Specifically, we looked at in-stream structure, modeling wood recruitment using the buffer widths that we reviewed a moment ago, in conjunction with ODF stream inventory, ODF forest inventory data grown forward over the permit term. We also modeled stream temperature, targeted modeling of segments with warming based that are susceptible to warming based on aspect, channel width, and shading, relying on literature to justify riparian buffer performance for temperature. Sediment delivery specifically was not modeled. We assume the stream buffers are sufficient to minimize sediment delivery from non-road sources. And we assume that road management direction and best management practices minimize sediment delivery from the transportation network. The aquatic modeling results support the riparian conservation areas as effective for both wood recruitment and temperature protection. Riparian conservation areas capture 99% of the available wood over the permit term. 88% of that comes from standing trees in the buffers on fish-bearing streams from adjacent riparian tree fall. 12% of the total wood is recruited from debris flow. And 45% of the non-fish-bearing streams deliver wood to fish-bearing streams, oftentimes because they are part of the component, part of that debris flow track, as we saw in the diagram a moment ago. Streams with a southerly aspect and a maximum channel width were looked at to determine if they were sensitive to warming. And it turns out that 67 miles of stream within the permit area are susceptible to warming. And I'm glad to say that's less than 1% of the total stream, total fish stream miles in the permit area. While RCAs are the core component of properly functioning aquatic and riparian habitat over the long term, roads management and targeted restoration activities are also important conservation strategies. Transportation planning during the HCP implementation will employ management direction and best management practices to minimize sediment delivery to streams, allow for proper sediment routing, and minimize the removal of trees from riparian conservation areas. Where feasible, new road construction and RCAs will be avoided and roads will be placed on ridgetop locations. Best design and construction practices will be used when building or improving roads, including installation culverts that meet NOAA fisheries and ODFW fish passage standards during new construction or when replacing old culverts. We will also vacate roads no longer needed for management and are at risk of failure or are contributing sediment to streams. Restoration activities will be used to provide near-term enhancement to aquatic environments, prioritized based on the limiting factors for independent populations of covered species. Examples of this include large wood placement, creation of deep pools and off-channel habitat to buffer against high and low flows and offer additional temperature protection, and the removal of artificial barriers. In addition to in-kind support, such as donation of logs to in-stream wood projects, a conservation fund will be established under the HCP to support both aquatic and upland conservation projects to benefit covered species in the permit area. This will provide stability over time to ensure projects can be implemented during fluctuating market conditions. Now I will present the terrestrial conservation strategy. It focuses on increasing the quantity and quality of habitat over the permit term by building on areas of known species occurrence, current suitable and highly suitable habitat, and landscape connectivity. A combination of passive and active management will be used to protect and enhance habitat over the permit term. Habitat conservation areas have been drafted based on a number of important concepts for the covered species. First, HCAs provide active northern spotted owl activity centers, marbled murrelet occupied habitat, and red tree vole nests. In the case of northern spotted owls and marbled murrelets, we have almost 30 years of surveys and research to guide us on where they occur. Our information is more limited for tree voles, where known occurrences on the permit area result from sporadic research efforts, although we are currently supporting cooperative research to learn more. HCAs also include historic northern spotted owl activity centers with a consistent history of occupancy and reproduction. While some of these sites have not been had a response history in some time, they still represent some of the better core habitats on the permit area. As drafted, HCAs incorporate the majority of modeled suitable habitat for covered terrestrial species. I'll give more detail on that in a moment. Large swaths of forest ODF manages have lower suitability, but are incorporated to provide connectivity both across that landscape and from or among adjacent federal lands. While passive management will play an important role in the habitat conservation areas, the HCAs or the HCP will use active management within HCAs to help meet the biological goals and objectives for the species. This is an important distinction for management outside of HCAs. Activities within HCAs will not be economically driven, although positive volume and revenue gains may result from them. The impetus for management activities within HCAs will be to increase the quantity and quality of habitat over the permit term. Silvicultural treatments include density management to accelerate the development of large trees and canopy diversity, selective harvest with variable retention strategies to promote horizontal diversity and patch dynamics that are also used to treat diseases such as laminated root rot, and even regeneration harvest to treat stands with low potential to grow into habitat for covered species, such as stands that are severely infected with Swiss needle cast disease, or hardwood stands that have little or no conifer component. All of these activities will be designed to minimize short-term negative effects on the covered species while still achieving long-term habitat development. The pace and scale of these activities within HCAs is still being determined, but many of the activities will occur earlier in the permit term so that the habitat gains can be realized during the permit term. The exact boundaries of habitat conservation areas are still being refined. Currently, HCAs are expected to cover between 273,000 to 289,000 acres across the entire permit area. This represents 43 to 45% of the permit area. Biologists have defined 200 discrete HCAs across the landscape, ranging from 20 acres to 60,000 acres. Almost half of these HCAs fall into the 100 to 500 acre size class. Size varies based on the functional objective and ownership pattern in a particular area. For instance, some smaller HCAs are reflective of patchwork ownerships where habitat on the permit area helps support adjacent species sites on federal lands or connectivity between federal habitats. Many of the HCAs in the 100 to 500 acre range support sites on ODF managed lands and allow for future habitat ingrowth between these sites. There are very few large HCAs located where ODF is the only significant public land manager and provides nearly all of the habitat support and landscape connectivity for known species occurrences. Generally speaking, smaller HCAs would be subjected to less intensive management activities, whereas larger HCAs on the North Coast coincide with previously mentioned forest health concerns and will likely see more management activity. ODF and ICF work together to adapt existing published models to key attributes from ODF's forest inventory data in order to characterize current conditions and future outcomes for four of the covered terrestrial species. The models were then reviewed by their original authors, who were accepting of how models were adapted and offered some suggestions for improvement. The results of habitat suitability were divided into general habitat categories of unsuitable, marginally suitable, low suitability, suitable, and highly suitable. This modeling effort shows that habitat conservation areas incorporate almost all of the current highly suitable habitat and the majority of suitable habitat for northern spotted owls and marbled murrelets. This is not surprising given our knowledge of those species occurrence that was key to designating the habitat conservation areas. Far less is known about both the occurrence and the range of habitat suitability for red tree voles and Oregon slender salamander. Still, most of the modeled highly suitable habitat for both species is captured within habitat conservation areas. Here's the combined estimated acres of HCA and RCA, which comprise 49 to 52% of the permit area. It is important to note that the strategies complement one another. RCAs for small perennial non-fish streams are important for Columbia and Cascade Torrent salamanders. The stream reaches within HCAs will benefit from less intensive pace and scale of management that will provide additional protections from overall thermal loading and low summer flows. Together, they represent a robust conservation strategy that we believe will meet the biological goals and objectives for the covered species. And now I will turn it over to Brian Pugh, who will cover the forest goals and objectives and forest management modeling.
Good afternoon, Chair Imeson, State Forester Daugherty, and all members of the board. For the record, my name is Brian Pugh. I serve as the policy deputy for the State Forest Division. And so I'm going to start today by walking you through the forest goals and objectives. And similar to the biological goals and objectives that drove those conservation strategies that Mike just walked us through, the forest goals and objectives are really important, and they've been being used internally to ensure there is a balance of greatest permanent value being developed as we develop the HCP. So the HCP is a really good conservation tool, and it provides assurances that it meets the Endangered Species Act. It does not by itself implement greatest permanent value. Those other elements of greatest permanent value that are very important to Oregon State Forest, and these forest goals capture those. So I'll show you on the next slide, or this slide here, that these goals and objectives are in the context of greatest permanent value within HCP. And so they were created by ODF staff and reviewed with stakeholders and other experts. We will be using these as kind of the keystone, the overarching objectives when we develop a companion forest management plan. And as Cindy showed earlier in the presentation, that if we are directed to go into the NEPA process with the HCP, staff would begin working on a companion forest management plan. So today, as I show you these, it's an overview. If we work on a forest management plan, a companion forest management plan, we would be coming back to you, the Board of Forestry, to discuss these in more detail. They are divided into three categories of social, environmental, and economics, and you'll recognize those are the three primary elements of greatest permanent value. You can see on the next slide, it highlights the overarching goals. And on the social one, it's to support local and statewide Oregon economies and community well-being. The economic goal is to ensure stable and predictable revenues across Western Oregon forest permit area over the long term. And on the environmental one is to maintain, enhance, or restore the health of Western Oregon state forests, thereby promoting sustainability, productivity, and resilient ecosystems. Your board materials that you had before you today have more detail in those, and there's objectives underneath them. Similarly, as we design the species goals, these are the same format. And again, we would come back to you and work with and discuss these more if we'd use them to develop a companion forest management plan. It's important to note that these have been used to balance the conversation and balance the thinking internally and with stakeholders as we develop this HCP. with that in mind, I'll transition to the next slide and the next topic, which is the policy level force management modeling. And this is really some technical tools being used to test the concepts and support the decision making. And so when we think about this policy level force management modeling, it's important to understand that it's a tool for decision making and a tool to help understand the outcomes. You can see on this slide, there's some important elements that we are focused on and trying to achieve. And when we talk about supporting the decision-making made by ODF, we're really using it to refine our concepts and our approaches and strategies. And so a lot of the details that Mike just went over with you were discussed and concepts came up, and we're using these model runs to see how they play out on the landscape. It's giving us a good perspective of what the expected outcomes would be. And so that's an important thing to understand, is to anticipate the HCP expected outcomes. When we come to you, board, in October with a comparative analysis, and that comparative analysis is essentially the business decision-making tool for you all, the modeling will be refined. And so the numbers Mike just showed had some ranges in there. The numbers I'm about to show also have some ranges in there. We continue to make improvements and refinements to both the habitat conservation areas and then also the modeling tools itself. And so, again, these are preliminary results that we thought it was very important to get in front of you today. Also, as you heard Brett and others talk about, it was important information for the stakeholders to start to see and understand too. But keep that in mind that these are preliminary results. And so another important thing that the modeling does is it's set up to look at the full range of GPV outcomes. And so that includes, you know, volume to support local jobs and revenues to the counties. And also it can show how recreation and visuals and play out on the landscape. We are using this model in the HCP development to inform the effects analysis. That's a really important piece of the HCP development to ensure that there's an overall net benefit to the species. When we think about volume and timber harvest, volume is an outcome of this model. And so we didn't use this model to set a volume number or to set an outcome. As you heard me say earlier, it's really to refine our concepts and approaches, both for the strategies for the species, but also how we manage the forest. And so those forest goals set the silviculture standards and other management techniques that we use to manage Oregon's forests. The last thing I'll note, and I'll go into more detail soon, is the models across the ODF management lands in the permit area. And so we are, in fact, talking from the Columbia River at Astoria all the way down to the California border and everything west of the Cascade Crest. And so it's a large geographic area. What we have done for many reasons is to break that area down into smaller subgeographic areas. And again, you all are familiar with the North Coast and the iconic Tillamook and Clatsop State Forest. And so that would be our North Coast region. And then we have a Willamette Valley region, which includes our San Diego State Forest and our Western Oregon office. And then Southern Oregon area, which is from our Bonita office, again, all the way to the California border, with that includes lots of scattered tracks. These areas were designed with several things in mind. One was our mill customers. The purchasers of state forest trees and logs are really important to a vital and business model. And we looked at mills in those areas, those three subgeographic regions, and tracked how much, historically, how much state forest wood went into those mills. And so we looked at that. Another important piece is our workforce. And as you all know, we went through a large reorganization in the State Forest Division in the last couple of years. One of the key tenets of that reorganization was to flow to work, and that is to allow people to work from one office to the other. And those are typically how we flow with the North Coast people in Tillamook working in Forest Grove or Astoria. And then again, if you're in San Diego, you'd be working in possibly Western Oregon and flowing to the priorities to, so we can ensure the most important work of the division gets done. Another element of those areas is the species and how they're grouped up, with the marble murrelet and salamanders being in different locations. And it also helps when we think about the counties. And as you know, we have 16 forest trust land counties, and there are each individual counties and the two are in those groupings. And so as you see results and you hear us talking about them, these are kind of our terms that we are looking at areas there. You saw Mike's numbers in that on the conservation, and then you'll see my numbers on the harvest volumes in that too. So we'll go to the next slide. I'm thinking we skip the slide and we go back one. Okay. I'm going to speak a little bit to the model outcomes that we're going to be evaluating before we get to the final numbers. And so the important model outcomes, the model tells us many things. And what we are looking at closely, thank you for that slide. What we are looking at closely would be the timber harvest volume. When we think about the timber harvest volume, we are really looking over 70 years. And so that is a long-term commitment. And over 70 years, we are trying to get the best outcomes to implement greatest permanent value on Oregon State Forest. We do not expect a even flow of harvest over the next 7 years because of the conditions of Oregon, current conditions of Oregon State Forest, and to meet the needs of the species, we expect the timber harvest volume to change over time. Those harvest volumes would actually be set in implementation plans. So again, as you see the numbers today, know that the modeling go through another iteration, but even after those numbers we bring to you in October, it'll furtherly be refined from an operational sense in our implementation plans, similar as we do today. And those implementation plans are 10-year plans. And so we expect decade by decade, the volumes will fluctuate over the life of the permit term. What we're trying to do here is, you know, not compare ourselves to the last 5 years, but really look out for the next 70 years and see what volumes we can get. Another important part is revenue. And as you know, the majority of the revenue, about 64%, is distributed to the counties. The remaining 36% is retained by ODF to cover all aspects of forest management, greatest permanent value, the recreation program, our education program, and it would include the cost of implementing the habitat conservation plan. Another element we're looking at closely is the forest inventory over time. And so over 70 years, we're using this policy level management model to understand how Oregon's forests change over time with the management and how that management benefits the species. And specific to the species, we're looking at the covered species, the habitat quality and quantity over time, and ensuring that the quality and the quantity of the habitat is improving over time. And that is feeds directly into the effects analysis. Fifth element that we're looking at, and again, keep in mind, these are five, you know, important elements. There's lots of other outcomes of the model that we evaluate internally, but we thought talking to you today, these would be the five most important elements for the board to understand that we're looking at. And so when we look at carbon storage, we really want to understand how Oregon's forests contribute to carbon storage. We know carbon storage is important worldwide. We know it's important to Oregon. We know it's a topic right now in Oregon, and we want to understand how state forests contribute to that carbon storage And specifically what we're looking at is the bole of a tree and how much carbon is stored in the bole of a tree. And so we don't have at State Forest, at ODF, we don't have a carbon storage project plan. We don't plan to sell carbon at this time, but we do think it's really important to understand our how we contribute to that carbon storage. So those are five elements there. And then we will move on to kind of the expected outcomes, the expected harvest volumes that will come. There's the map that I explained, and then here's the harvest volumes. Thank you. It's important to understand that the conservation strategies that Mike talked about, both the HCAs and the RCAs, provide the benefits to the species, which would result in an HCP permit. And then the department really will determine the harvest levels in the implementation plans with the goals and strategies and the forest goals that we briefly showed earlier. And so these numbers today are, again, are preliminary. And it's important to note these are 70-year averages. And over the life of the turret term, we do expect the harvest levels to undulate based on forest conditions and species and needs. Those fluctuations in harvest could be as much as 20% plus or minus these numbers you're seeing today. And so through time, the harvest could go up.
Ryan, can you hold for just a second?
Sure.
Brenda has a question. I assume it's just a clarification question while you're here. So let me, is that correct, Brenda?
That'd be great.
Yes, yeah, thank you, Tom, and thanks, Brian. You know, it occurred to me as I was reviewing this, I wondered what approach you took when you modeled timber volume outside of the HCAs and the RCAs. Did you follow the basically the approach under the current plan, under the draft revised plan, or some other approach?
Yeah, that's a good question. And it would be, I'd say, more under the draft revised plan of that approach on those silviculture strategies. We are still dialing them in, but it is not structure-based management. It is a more of a timber approach with those longer harvest rotations and many elements that contribute to species of that are listed here in the 15 that we're trying to cover, but also are species of concern. And so as far as some elements like the downwood and the green tree retention are very similar to what we do now.
Thank you, Brian.
And while we're clarifying, just I'll add a question. So you mentioned that you don't, you anticipate there would be departures from the average annual growth over the 70-year period. Are you anticipating that those departures would be earlier in the period or sporadically, or could you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, that's another good question, the departure over time. And again, we're thinking about a 7 year, so very long time period,
right,
which is
right.
Important to note. And so as we think about that, I think the other thing before I answer your question, Tom, if you give me just a minute, is the fact that through the HCP permitting process, the federal services are not permitting a harvest level. So the federal services are not, but they are permitting take of the habitat, and that affects the harvest level for sure. And so these are, you know, these questions around harvest levels and silviculture techniques are in the forest management plan, and we will be working internally with staff to dial them in, but also with the board after October if we go into the MEPA process. So currently what you're seeing is how we set up the model is to have a departure to regulate the age of the forest. And so we know with the inception of the Tillamook State Forest, we have a lot of similar age class. And so in the beginning, the harvest level is higher than the averages. And then over the life of the permit term, maybe about 40 years in, it goes below those averages. And then near the end of the permit term, the last, you know, half to third, if you will, the harvests start coming up. as the goals of the species are fully achieved and Oregon's forests continue to grow. And so quite simply, it starts off higher than average, dips below average, and then comes back again at the end of the 70 years is what we are expecting.
Okay, that's helpful. And Joe also has a question.
Brian, do these volumes include HCA restoration activities? I would imagine with the sheer number of acres committed to HCAs, there must be significant restoration to meet habitat goals related to increase the quality of habitat. I'm making that assumption. I mean, I know the significant restoration that needs to happen on the Tillamook related to the Swiss needle cast and alder, and with the sheer amount of acres in the HCAs, there must be significant restoration, I'm assuming. And are they a part of these numbers?
Yes. So the management activities in the HCAs, as you heard from Mike, will be designed to benefit the species, but they will produce volume, and that volume is in those numbers. We do expect to refine that more in the next round of modeling, to refine the HCA work a little bit more and those volume numbers to come up a little bit. It's also important to note is that is one of the reasons for the higher harvest levels early on is that restoration work. As Mike noted, we want to do that restoration work early on in those HCAs so the benefits of the species can happen during the permit term. And that's part of the assurances on our end that we provide those benefits. And so those higher numbers, that departure from even flow early on, does have some to do with the work we plan to do in the HCA's habitat conservation areas for the species.
Well, we have a basic understanding of the total acres needing restoration within the HCA's and just a basic idea. You say up front, that makes a lot of sense, but the sheer scale of that is huge. I'm just trying to get my mind around how are you going to begin to quantify that for us?
Yeah, we can talk about it. There's broad categories that we're looking at, which is one, our Swiss needle cast zones on the coast where they're really not growing. And what we want to do there is really promote those into species that are growing faster. There's other places where we have alder and hardwoods that we want to get growing faster. And then the third place would be thinnings to promote growth, more habitat growth on those. And so those three broader categories. And we can, when we come back in October with more refined model results, we can talk about that restoration work more so everybody understands it. Because I think it's important to note that when we do that work, it does benefit the species in there and make that link for you all and the publics as to the management work, the silviculture actions, and how it benefits the species that we're trying to get permitted.
Hey, Brian, I think Mike Wilson has something to add to Joe's question.
Great.
Yeah, thanks. I don't have all the numbers right here in front of me, so I'm trying to recall, but for instance, the Swiss needle cast severity, that rehab looks like about 45,000 acres within habitat conservation areas. I'm not sure what the alder acres are. You know, they're probably they're less than that, but, you know, similar situation. And we are still trying to refine the thresholds for management and the frequency of management. That's part of the ongoing dialogue that we're having in the scoping team meetings. And so that's not quite figured out in the model. So as Brian was saying, these numbers could, you know, potentially come up a little bit or whatever. But again, that's not the, you know, just back to what he said, that's not the objective in these areas. So there would be a volume bump. Certainly, we don't know exactly what that would be, though.
Thanks, Brian, for responding to those questions. We'll let you continue now and get to the wrap up.
Yeah, those were great questions. And I'm on my last bullets on these slides. And really the next steps, as I've said a few times, is to refine the habitat conservation area configuration. So the physical design of them on the landscape, but then also to
to dial in better, to adjust better those management activities within them. And then adjustments to the forest management model, which is, you know, continually to make model improvements and then to work on our silviculture practices, to Brenda's question, to work on our silviculture practices outside of the HCAs. And so those are our next steps. We're going to do that here within the next 3 or 4 weeks. We're already working on it now. And that information, that will be the model run that we use to inform the comparative analysis. That will be the model run that you have before you for your decision making in October. And so again, another important step that we're working on in the next month there. And so with that, appreciate everybody staying with me while I fumbled through the slides out of order there, and then also the questions. I'm going to turn it to Liz, and she's got a slide or two, and then we'll come back to questions. So thank you.
Thanks.
Great. Thank you, Brian. So this slide here just highlights some of the stuff you've already been hearing about, quite honestly. So continued work with the scoping team and the steering committee here between now and October, continuing to push our sleeves up, getting good feedback from the public, from stakeholders, hope to solicit more input from county commissioners as we take another look at the configuration and the strategies that we're putting in place in the forest goals and meeting those objectives so we can bring together to you in October the draft proposal. Do want to remind you that we are coming to you in September for your board meeting with an update on the forest management plan. You may recall we had a whole day scheduled to go over the draft Western Oregon forest management plan and sort of put that on the side burner while continuing to work on the HCP. That meeting day was canceled given, it seems like 10 years ago now, but that was when we were first struggling to respond to the pandemic. So we ended up canceling that day. We did eke out a little bit of time on your September board agenda item to just bring you a couple of different elements from that body of work that was done on that draft FMP. And so looking forward to that conversation. And then we're going to tee up this comparative analysis. We've mentioned it a couple times today. I think everyone, you know, knows what that is, but it is a comparison of the draft Western Oregon FMP, the current forest management plan, and the HCP. And with that, the board would be teed up to make your decision in October. That's October 6th. It's a special meeting to determine if you want us to continue working on the HCP and move into the NEPA process. So a lot of work between now and October, and then October itself is going to be a big day. You heard a lot about the public engagement. I think that Brett did a great job summarizing a lot of pieces that are going on. Here on this slide, I'm just highlighting the public meeting on September 16th, but there's quite a bit of outreach outside of that just that one single public meeting. And then we have talked about the county engagement, I think, several times today. And just know, please, that we know that that's important to the board to hear from the commissioners, and we're doing everything we can to give them the information they need to weigh in accordingly.
Okay. I know there are some questions. I've got one or two maybe to start with, Liz. So, and some of these have to do with and I realize they are preliminary results that Brian just talked about. But you started your presentation reminding us of some of the history, and one of those pieces of history was the business case that was undertaken and delivered to the board, I think, in late 2018. And I'm curious about the numbers that we just heard, specifically the potential harvest numbers, and what I'm asking you, are those consistent with what you anticipated when we when you brought us the business case?
I'll kick off the answer, and then it's kind of hard when we're all in separate spaces here to eyeball who's going to give the answer. So, but probably Mike or Brian can close it out.
What I would say is that the trends, well, let me back up. So with the business case, we had, of course, we were making several assumptions because we didn't have a set of conservation strategies in front of us to use to drive that those model outcomes. So the big difference between now, obviously, when now we have some strategies to put into a model and then is greater clarity around what we think an HCP would look like. Mike, do you want to weigh in? Mike Wilson will help out here as well.
Yeah, thanks. And, you know, really good question. And what we're trying to do, we are trying to, I think the trends were correct for the business case analysis overall in terms of habitat and habitat future encumbrances. One key thing to remember with the business case analysis is it was predicated on the current forest management plan. That was the context for it at the time. And it was about acres that would flow from our current desired future condition into different levels of encumbrances under take avoidance versus under an HCP. And in this dynamic, it's quite a bit different because we are not, as Brian mentioned earlier, we're not presuming the structure-based management approach of the current FNP on the landscape in general with this modeling effort. For the HCP.
So I think what that comes up to say is yes, the trends are as we would anticipate, that as we would have anticipated back in fall of 2018. The difference being with this, what we're doing now and the results that you're seeing now, we are assuming that we'll be managing the land base in sort of a couple different ways. One is restoration to further conservation objectives, and the other one is a sort of an age-regulated framework. So that's very different, of course, than under the forest management plan, which is the structured-based management.
Okay. It's about 3:15. Several folks have questions. We have a break scheduled right now for 10 minutes and then return on this topic. I'm kind of looking at my colleagues. Would you like to, and you guys, would you like to continue with the questions or take a quick break? And I'm just looking at nods of heads from like, I'm fine either way. If you, that looks to me like keep going, Joe. You okay with that, Brenda? You're the only two I see right now. Okay, let's keep going. So, Brenda, I think you had you had your hand up first there.
Yeah, just a point of clarification. Liz, could you remind us what the schedule is for accepting the revised FMP as a companion to an HCP? When is that decision made relative to the final decision on the HCP?
Sure. Those will ultimately coincide. Let me get back to my schedule here, Brenda.
Thank you for that question, Brenda. So what we would be doing is we would be using the revised forest management plan as a base for the companion FMP for the HCP, but it certainly isn't just taken as the companion in its whole. We're using the structure of it in terms of it having the right geographic space because it's the same as the HCP. And it also has a lot of the updated materials that we did with our resource assessment. How we are, the exact terms of how we're managing the forest and how that coincides with the habitat conservation areas and other aspects of the HCP will still be developing as we're putting that companion FMP together. So it isn't, I wouldn't say it's the revised FMP is in wholesale the companion FMP to the HCP. That's a lot of acronyms. So we would begin doing that in October, after October, and if you direct us to move forward. And then we'd be bringing that back to you the following year in November for your consideration. And so that's when you would be giving, and we would also, during that time, we would have a stakeholder engagement process. So that would sort of run concurrently with NEPA. And then the plan would be the following year, about 6 months after that, in June of 2022, we bring those two products to you together.
Good. Thank you, Cindy. One point that I guess I would offer up as something to think about is you've done an outstanding job working with the federal agencies to develop a plan to consider the habitat for these listed species, and that's great. You know, if you were to have a companion forest management plan that considers species that are not listed but could be in the future, you know, how can you actively manage those stands, produce timber, you know, feed the mills, feed the economy, but also ensure that you're not going to put other species at risk along the way, and give that the same level of attention that you've given the HCP.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Jim Kelly and then Joe Justice.
So obviously there's some voices in industry that are not very pleased to see this initial modeling work. I've heard and seen the comparisons made to other HCPs for private landowners. And it's obvious to me that as a public landowner and with GPV, as Liz, as you were saying earlier, that's kind of an apples and oranges comparison. But on the other hand, they're arguing that there's significant more land being set aside, upland in particular. Is there anything at this point, Liz, Brian, whoever, that you can explain to us that would give those people any better understanding of why we are exactly where we are with this initial modeling?
Yeah, Jim, this is Brian. I think I appreciate you passing on that question there, and I've got three or four things that come to mind, and then I'll pass it to Liz and the team in Salem there. But one of the things that comes to mind is the sheer land base. So we're talking 600,000 acres from Oregon to the California border, from Washington. And so it's a large piece of land that has a well-managed forest on it. And so we have a wide range of age class, a lot of it that's older on that forest, on that landscape. And so, put bluntly, we do have a lot of habitat for species, for endangered species on that landscape. In addition, we have 15 species that we're trying to get permitted on. Most of them are listed, but some of them are not. Some of them we expect and have good reason to expect that we future listings. And so we are contributing to species that aren't on the endangered species list. And you put those elements on there, and that starts adding up our conservation commitment, what we need to commit to meet the services requirements. The other thing that's really important and something to be proud of is that ODF has been supporting and surveying for species for a long time. And so we started with some of the first owl and some of the first murrelet surveys. And all that survey data, we have a robust survey program that we spend millions of dollars a year on. And so we have that data set on a really healthy, unique forest, if you will. And so that adds up to a lot of commitment that we need to protect the species. So those are the elements that I think about, and I'll look to Liz to see if she wants to add anything there.
No, Brian, I think you captured the thoughts that I would have shared. So Cindy or Mike? Nothing more to add here.
That's really helpful. Thank you, guys.
Joe.
Thanks. Brian, I guess I want to just drill just a little bit further into the business case, make sure, getting back to Tom's question, just to try to understand that, because it maybe it's because it was the first board meeting, and I think it was one of the first board meetings I attended, so I remember that pretty clearly, and it seemed that the you know, business case comparison that we were shown, you know, compared basically in some respects about 50% of the acres managed on state forests being having policy constrained issues with them related to species, and then with an HCP, you know, a movement away from that to you know, a greater amount of acres being not as constrained by policy. And I guess one of the things, I guess maybe I thought I understood at that time, is Brian spoke to quality and quantity, of habitat of these HCAs. And it would seem, as it's fair to say, is my understanding, that the quantity is established by the HCAs that are established in the HCP. That doesn't change. I'm guessing that's a fair statement. Secondly, I guess I was under the assumption that as we increase quality of habitat, the effect of quality of habitat, we would maybe not need is the quantity. So I guess, can you speak to that, Brian or Liz? And is that the, I mean, I'm just trying to understand the difference between the business case analysis, the difference between where we are now at this current, and I understand it's a draft, I'm trying to understand that. Between the quantity and the quality.
Yeah, Joe, I think that's a really good question. And I'd say on the business case itself, what we've learned, you know, that was about 2 years ago, we've learned a lot about what it takes to get an HCP. And so a lot of our assumptions are recalibrated, if you will, and the numbers do look different. Again, the trend lines look the same. And so when we think about the quality and the quantity of the habitat, we are very much getting a take permit. And so we will, to some extent, take habitat, harvest habitat. And over time, though, we'll provide an overall benefit and how we're measuring benefit to the species to ensure the compliance with the Endangered Species Act. And how we measure that benefit will be the quantity and quality of the habitat. And so when we think about the HCAs, in those HCAs as they're currently designed, there's young plantations in there. There's a range from, you know, almost bare dirt that needs to be planted because we just harvested this year to older mature forests. And that whole range of forests can be inside an HCA. And so through time, we expect to move the quantity, if you will. And so that quantity of the habitat in the HCA is an, while the HCAs are set numbers, the habitat within there are not set numbers. So we're going to try to grow that forward. And yes, we improve the quality, which provides another benefit. It's important to note, though, that not all the habitat is in the HCAs. There are areas of older forests that could potentially be quality habitat that will be harvested because they're outside the HCAs. And that's the trade-off, if you will, that outside the HCAs, we could potentially be harvesting some of that habitat and then inside growing more, growing it back. And that's the balance we're trying to work with our management plans, implementing greater sperm value, and then try to balance it with the services to make sure it's acceptable to them to get the permit.
This is Liz. Let me weigh in here for a minute. A lot of conversation around the business case analysis and terminology matters. And so we'll be coming back in October with what we're calling the comparative analysis. And it's basically a repeat, if you will, of the business case analysis. But now, instead of using a bunch of assumptions for the HCP, we have clarity around what an HCP might look like as it's framed up in October. So I just want to be clear with you all that that's the plan. There's the question around the trends is an important one. We keep saying that the trends are the same, and there's some confused faces because in that business case analysis with the assumptions used at that time, we anticipated the same or increasing harvest levels under an HCP as compared to decreasing harvest levels without an HCP. And so I think, Joe, is that what you're getting at? Yes.
Is that that was certainly what I was getting at as well, Liz. That's why I asked how these numbers align with what we were thinking about the business case.
Yeah, exactly. And so I want to be completely transparent that, yeah, that is what the business case said at the time. Now we're sharing numbers that would indicate a decrease in harvest levels as compared to what we do right now. And that, you know, at face value, one would say, well, that's a different trend. I want to go back to the point that, you know, we run into troubles when you use averages. I heard a statistician say the trouble with averages is, think of the guy with his feet on ice and his head on fire. On average, he's doing great, but you really have no idea what his life is like if you just use an average. So we're talking about a 70-year average. And Brian talked about the fact, the notion that there would be sort of this oscillation with high harvest levels in the beginning and then a decrease and then picking back up again as the forest inventory rebuilds again. That's how the model sort of plays it out in modeled world. So when we say trends, I think that's what's in our minds when we say the trends are the same, but the conclusion, if you will, that was drawn in November of 2018, that harvest levels would be higher than under the current plan, is gonna have to be revisited. And when we come back in October, we will repeat this, include another example with the draft Western Oregon Forest Management Plan, the board will be able to then make the decision about if you want us to keep moving forward or not. There are trade-offs. And I think what we're seeing as we've been working through this over the past year and a half, Cindy's going, what are you talking about? What we've come to realize is that the expectation, the forest characteristics that we have, the information that we have on occurrence has really highlights the importance of this land base and the ability of it to provide for conservation for the species that we're seeking coverage on. And that, you know, truly is shaping now what we think at this point would be the potential harvest levels over 70 years. And it's different than what we thought, quite frankly, in November 2018.
Right. And I think one of the other, and I by the way, I really appreciate the work that has been done on this. I just think we want to be able to, you know, clearly understand impacts, but also understand as best we can impacts of the path we were on, which was a take avoidance plan. Which also would have likely had some of the impacts that we're talking about right now. But I think we need to be able to explain those and understand those. And remember, too, that one of our goals as a board has been improving financial viability of state forests. And that definition may mean slightly different things to different folks, but improvement is what we're looking for, and I think that's another backdrop for this. I see Cindy's got a question or comment as well.
Yeah, sort of another aspect to add into this whole conversation about business model. If I'm remembering the numbers right, the HCP is covering 15 different species.
16.
How many of those 15 are currently listed?
Do you want to answer that, Cindy?
Yeah, it is 16 species, and Troy, check me. I believe there are 6 that are unlisted.
Okay. So part of, I think, what our business model analysis or the analysis under its new name when you come back to us in October also needs to incorporate is the fact that with the HCP, we will have coverage for those additional 6 species that we anticipate are going to be listed. And so we've got that added degree of certainty, whereas if we maintained a take avoidance approach, we're really kind of launching into a slightly more uncertain future because we don't know for sure what additional constraints would impact our harvest as those additional six species are listed.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. Yeah, that's exactly right, Cindy. And I was sort of chomping at the bit, so I'm glad that you brought that up, because one of sort of the cornerstones of the business case analysis was anticipating what those future encumbrances would be. And really what we did was we looked at our inventory, and the red tree vole was one of the big players in future encumbrances. And it was a bit of a swag because that's where we were. It was science-based. I know Nick is probably on here, so it's not to be offensive. But now we do have the species models that Mike spoke to. And so not only are those applied across the landscape to help inform the HCAs, they will also be applied to the take avoidance approaches. That way that those are compared equitably. And so, you know, what you've seen today, and I understand these questions because this comparative analysis is, you know, a really helpful decision-making tool. And so what you've seen today is a work in progress. We are still working on the modeling. We don't have we're applying those species models to the take avoidance strategies right now. And so we're not able to say it's plus or minus this for the business case. And we've actually, you know, back to another point that was made, that Joe made around habitat quality and quantity, we didn't really explore quality. And so we are able to do that now. And so we're going to have a few more pieces for you to be considering in the comparative analysis than that initial assumption-based business case analysis. Mm-hmm. And but ultimately, this really is a policy decision. And we're going to do our best to give you our anticipated outcomes, conservation-wise, economic, and social. But we're not, there's still going to be modeled and there's still going to be some assumptions there. And so, we're going to do our best to give you a good comparative analysis, but really ultimately it's a policy decision that we have to consider making about how we're going to, balance certainty and uncertainty and management of our forests over 70 years.
Thank you, Cindy. I think Cindy really just captured the gist of what's going on here. The business case was an initial analysis based on a set of assumptions to see if we thought it was a good idea, if the board thought it was a good idea. We were very clear that there were a lot of assumptions built into that business case, and what it showed was a significant difference from take avoidance to HCP that it was, the board decided it was worth exploring in HCP. The idea you take now an analysis of a detailed, modeled, and constructed HCP to sort of almost a cartoon character business case doesn't make sense. So saying that the harvest from the HCP doesn't compare to the harvest from the business case is the wrong comparison. In your decision on whether to move forward with the HCP, as Cindy just said, is we'll want to compare the modeled draft HCP to a modeled take avoidance on the same frame of reference. And so we haven't done that work yet, but that's what you'll be seeing in October. So, you know, it is disappointing that we don't have the harvest going up. But again, the idea that right now you're looking at the true harvest level is also, it's a model. And so I think we have a lot more work to do, and we'll have pretty good comparison numbers when we arrive in October. So thank you, Cindy.
Thanks. We'll take a 10-minute break and reconvene at 3:45. And take up our next topic. This, I think, closes this topic.